Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Stephen Hill, author of 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy a few years back and co-founder of Fair Vote. We're going to talk about what I consider to be one of our gravest and most systemic problems, minority rule. And you can learn more about Stephen's work at fairvote.org. Stephen-Hill, that's Stephen with a V, Steven-Hill.com, and his frequent newsletters at democracysos, one word, democracysos.substack.com. And you can subscribe to that Substack newsletter, and he's putting out a lot of really good information. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at economics, politics, environment, science, health, culture, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific, streams weekly on the Progressive Voice Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, SoundCloud, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, first off, let me admit that I've said a lot of what I'm about to say before, but I say it again because it's only getting worse and more threatening. I assume that listeners to this show and all those who care about democracy are well aware of the challenges presented by gerrymandering, voter suppression, and election manipulation, as well as the concerted efforts by Republicans to expand the negative impacts of all three of those. At least since the Supreme Court's unprecedented 2001 decision in Bush v. Gore, the image that embodies those efforts to me is that of the 20th century reaching up out of the grave and grabbing the future by the throat and proclaiming, not so fast. The Republican Party, its beliefs and its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans. And so the only way they can survive and in many ways dominate is to game the system. Their voters are more likely to vote, especially in non-presidential elections, midterms, local elections, and they have strategically exploited that advantage to gerrymander electoral districts and pass laws to suppress voting, leading to Trump's Electoral College victory and unrepresentative GOP majorities in the Senate, the Supreme Court, and a majority of state legislatures and governorships. The U.S. holds only one national vote, that for president and vice president, and the Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988. That's 32 years. Think about that. Once in 32 years. Yet they've held the presidency nearly 12 of those years and have often held majorities in the Senate despite receiving millions fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections. The Senate map gives rural areas 2.5 times the voting power of big cities, meaning Democrats need to win Senate races by 6 to 7 points. Wyoming, with less than 600,000 residents, has the same voice in the Senate as California with 40 million. Quoting Stephen Hill, while the U.S. Senate is currently split 50-50 senators for each party, the Democratic half won over 41 million more votes than the Republican half and represents 56% of the American people. 16 conservative states with a smaller combined population than California's have a total of 32 Senate seats. GOP senators have not represented a majority of the population since 1999, yet Republicans have held a majority of Senate seats for most of the past 20 years. Unquote. The current application of the Senate filibuster means that with the exception of some budgetary bills, you need 60 votes to pass anything. 41 votes, representing only 20% of the country, can keep a bill from even being considered. And now let's turn to the court. Too many critical, real-world applications of the Constitution rely on norms rather than laws. And under Mitch McConnell, Republicans have ruthlessly exploited this weakness, and as a result, they dominate the Supreme Court. When the 6-3 court made their series of radical decisions in late June and early July, the most activist legal 2 weeks in my lifetime, they went against the majority of Americans on church and state, guns, environmental protection, the climate crisis, and women's rights. And they don't shy away from the expectation that they're eager to rewrite the law on LGBTQ rights and contraception. Based on the boldness and the extremism of these recent rulings, we have reason to fear what will happen when they consider issues of democracy in elections, as they have already done in a few cases and are set to do in the next term, not to mention emergency decisions they might hand down in the heat of battle, as was the case most decisively in Bush v. Gore. As Matthew Iglesias wrote on Vox.com, control of the courts allows Republicans to further tilt the electoral playing field, and waging judicial politics on a tilted playing field allows Republicans to control the courts. I suspect that the Supreme Court has overreached, and millions for the first time have been made aware of and upset by minority rule. And the first evidence might be the vote yesterday in Kansas to continue to protect abortion in that Republican state's constitution. Trust in the court is at an all-time low, and when the newly aroused become newly aware that there isn't much they can do about it, that the checks and balances they heard so much about if they were among the dwindling numbers who learned some civics, that those checks and balances don't apply to the court, I hope they will be angry. Some, however, will be resigned, seeing it as just another example of how the system is rigged and government doesn't work. Under the two most recent popular vote losers who won the presidency through the Electoral College, we've suffered the terror attacks of 9/11, the unwinnable wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Great Recession of 2008, and the failed response to the COVID-19 pandemic that has so far cost us 1 million lives and left us with an unfit economy. In addition to the Electoral College, Republicans use, as I've said, gerrymandering and voter suppression to thwart the will of the people. In the 2018 midterms in Wisconsin, Democrats swept narrow victories in the statewide races, secured 53% of the votes cast in elections for the lower house of the state legislature. But because of gerrymandering, the GOP won more than 60% of the seats. Knowing they'd be insulated from public backlash, the legislature held a special lame duck session during which they stripped power from the state executive branch and reassigned it to themselves. Something similar happened in Michigan that same year and in North Carolina 2 years earlier. I believe that sustained minority rule not only produces unpopular policies, but also weakens and sickens democracy, breeding cynicism and the sorts of tribal divisions we now face. I am now one of many to warn that our democracy is in deep trouble at a moment when the crises we face, climate, pollution, public health, inequality, democracy itself, racism, tribalism, nuclear weapons, cannot afford for us to fail. Stephen Hill is the author of 7 books, including the one I mentioned, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, and a number of others on the issues that we're talking about right here. He is the former policy director at the Center for Humane Technology, political reform director at New America, and a co-founder of Fair Vote. His opinion pieces have appeared in many outlets, including the Washington Post, New York Times, and CNN.com. And as I said, he currently writes frequently at democracysos.substack.com. Welcome again, Stephen Hill, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thank you, Terrence. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, August 3rd. So, Stephen, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. We've got an hour. Can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you're doing today and what drives you? And feel free to go way back to mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, thank you for that invitation. I've been involved in political reform efforts in the United States for about 30 years now. When I co-founded Fair Vote, what is now called Fair Vote, but we've gone through 3 different name changes, and we founded it in 2002. And before that, I had been involved in politics, organizing campaigns, running campaigns at the grassroots level. And, like many people, just being involved in politics to the extent that I could as a volunteer. I was not really a paid professional, but finally at a certain point realized, you know what, why is it that they can have all these parties in a place like Germany or in France and other places, and in the U.S. we're stuck with this two-party Yabu system that we see where, you know, no matter which party you feel affiliated with, in some ways they're just extremely disappointing. These kind of big tent parties that try to be everything to everybody and end up being nothing to anybody. And so that just led me down a path of exploring, wow, there are different electoral systems, for example. Instead of using winner-take-all single-seat districts as we do in the United States, in places like Germany and Austria, Netherlands, they use proportional representation, in which if a party wins 10% of the popular vote, they win 10% of the seats instead of winning nothing like you get in the United States if you win 10%. And if you win 60% of the popular vote, you get 60% of the seats instead of winning everything like you get in the United States. And it's kind of a mind blower for a lot of people to realize you can take the same votes cast by the same voters and express them through different electoral systems, and you come up with completely different results in terms of who gets elected and who sits at the legislative table of power. And so this, you know, these sorts of epiphanies that I had, I then said, my goodness, we've got to tell Americans about this, because I think most Americans would like to have more choices at the ballot box. We would like to be able to have more parties. Already in, you know, many states and nationally, about 35 to 40% of voters identify as being independent mm-hmm. of the two major parties. This is a sign that people are not happy with the menu that we're being offered at this restaurant of American yeah. democracy. So more choice. I mean, it is kind of an irony that, you know, in America you have choices about, you know, 15 types of breakfast cereals and 20 times of different types of soap and a shampoo and toothpaste and all these things. We're choice. We're inundated with choice at so many levels. But when it comes to the political system, we are stuck with this two-painted bird that is rather drab and a real turkey.
Let me jump in for 1 second just to share my personal experience, which is that given especially the Republican Party of today, I am, the Democrats can count on me consistently voting for them. And I have to say that I believe that after every presidential election, after every big election, I say to myself, I wish I could hire a new agency to represent my feelings and my issues and my policies the way I would if this were marketing or advertising or that sort of thing. But you can't.
Exactly. And I think this is a frustration for many Americans. I'm people in my family who are conservative Republicans, they will tell you, I wish I had another choice too.
Yeah, of course.
And I've spent a fair amount of time in Germany and other parts of the EU studying their political systems. And, you know, you take a country like Germany where you have basically six political parties at the national level. You have two sort of major parties, but then you have a host of minority parties around them. And the minor parties tend to gain and lose in support depending on what the issues of the day are. Mm-hmm. And those minor parties are basically the laboratories for new ideas. That's where new ideas come from. So you have a more exciting and viable dialogue between the center and the edges of the political system, back and forth between the edge and the center, with issues coming and going. And so I just think that this is a better method for this modern society, this multi-everything society that we've become. We are really inhibited in more ways than we can even realize, because, you know, as someone once said, we don't know who discovered water, but we can be certain it wasn't a fish.
yeah, exactly.
So we don't understand the nature of the sea in which we are swimming. And if we did, we would realize that, wow, this is really the worst of political systems. If you look at the established democracies of the world, virtually all of them use some sort of proportional representation system. They do not have a second chamber like the United States Senate that has so much power. Most of them use parliamentary systems instead of a directly elected executive, so that you don't have this gap between, you know, the president from one party and the legislature from another party, and so they're at loggerheads and can't get anything done. I mean, if you were to design a new system for the United States of America and the country it is today, you would design a completely different system.
That's right. One thing two things that you've said that certainly hit home for me. One is that we have the oldest continuous constitution, but no one who has formed a constitution since then has copied it to the letter. We were more a model in the early days than we even are now, but no one has duplicated the Electoral College, you know, or as you say, many have a second body in the legislature, but if it is unrepresentative, it doesn't get as much power as the other one. The second thing I want to mention is a question that I had for later in the interview, but it's, you know, I know it's something that means a lot to you, because you and I actually did an interview many years ago on your book, The European Promise, that you have looked at what works in other countries that could happen here. And one of the questions that always haunts me is why Americans are, I don't even feel like we're resistant that much to what other countries do. We're just ignorant. Why we, who sort of pride ourselves on being the can-do culture, don't look around, see what's happening somewhere else, and make it even better and make it part of our own. This inability to see beyond our oceans and our borders is one of our real weaknesses, I believe.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, if you look at the 18th century founding of our country and the founding fathers and framers and you know, the people that created this, you see that they were very pragmatic. They looked around at what was democracy at the time. The only example was really the UK, Great Britain, which had a king. And they said, we can do better than that. And they basically came up with what they did out of whole cloth in reaction to the Articles of Confederation, which was completely broken. But you can see that they were very experimental at the time. They weren't stuck to the flypaper of old ideas like we are today, in which we bow down to this 18th century document, the United States Constitution, that is completely antiquated and unfit for this 21st century world.
And being those sorts of radical thinkers and experimentalists, they never meant for their Constitution to be held sacred.
They really didn't. In fact, Thomas Jefferson famously said we should tear up the U.S. Constitution every 19 years. I don't know why he picked 19 years rather than 20, but yeah. That's what he said. And that's, you know, and many of the founders and framers were of that mindset. They knew that they were creating something that they didn't really know if it would work.
And right. And
in the first presidential election, in fact, it broke down, and they did the First Amendment pretty quick after that to change that. And they also, I mean, you can go back and look at the annals of the Constitutional Convention, because James Madison, the father of the Constitution, wrote it all down. And you can see that they were confused about the creation of the presidency, the creation of the United States Senate. In fact, Madison and Alexander Hamilton both said that the United States Senate was a completely anti-majoritarian body that was going to create problems, and they were completely right. You know, in terms of slavery, for example, the U.S. House of Representatives passed resolutions to abolish slavery numerous times between the founding of the U.S. and 1860, when we had a civil war over the issue. It was always blocked in the anti-majoritarian United States Senate. So we have been dealing with the defects of what the founders and framers created ever since they created it. And yet it's just kind of laughable to see so many people bowing down to the founders and saying, oh, what they created was so brilliant and sacred, and we can't really change it. We have to have a literal interpretation of this 18th century democracy.
Yeah, I want to read, by the way, a quote that you quoted, but it's from Jefferson. And I just want people to know what his attitude, I mean, we sort of venerate him and then in turn venerate this document. Jefferson said, I'm certainly not an advocate for frequent and untried changes in laws and constitutions. But I know also that laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened as new discoveries are made, new truths disclosed, and manners and opinions change with the change of circumstances. Institutions must advance also and keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy, as civilized society to remain ever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. And you know, and he wasn't the only one. They understood that you need institutions, but those institutions need to adapt. It is unfortunate that one of the defects of that constitution that they created was it's so hard to amend.
Yes. You're right. If they had put their money where their mouth was, you know, in terms of, you get where I'm going, that if they were, if they really believed it should be amenable to revision with the times, they might have made amendments a little easier. How long has it been since we passed an amendment? And the last one was fairly insignificant, as I recall.
Well, let's see, I think it was the 1970s. And, you know, we passed one so the 18-year-old young Americans could vote, and we passed another one having to do with constitutional secession. So,
yeah, we're talking about 50 years.
Yeah.
And exactly. And if you could look at anything else that has not changed in the last 50 years.
Right. And you know, you look at a place like Chile, which is going through a constitutional convention process right now. On September 4th, in fact, they're going to vote on the new constitution that has been drafted by the delegates. They put a lot of thought into making sure that constitutional convention had a broad diversity of representation in choosing the delegates. And so they mandated, for example, that the delegates must be 50% women.
Yep.
So imagine if we had a constitutional convention in which we had a mandate for 50% women and other diverse representations in that convention. I think it would come up with a much different document than what we have today.
I'll tell you what, let's jump to that question right now, even though I slated it for later in our conversation. But, you know, let's just go with the flow. One, I want you to flesh out more Chile's experience. But the second was that I get emails from Common Cause, and they're warning me that if only six, I think it is now, it might be less, if only six more states join the call, that we could face an Article 5 constitutional convention. This is probably news to a lot of people. While some might see this as an opportunity, as you do, as you present it, you recently wrote a piece advocating for a constitutional convention and pointing to the model of what Chile has done and is doing. While some might see this as an opportunity to correct some flaws, doing away with the Electoral College, for example, the prospect scares the hell out of me. And that, I have to say that, and you're not the only. I talked with Lawrence Lessig, who I absolutely respect on these same issues, and he is for a constitutional convention. My fear is that, you know, in a country of tribalism, in a country of sadly ignorance, in a country of misinformation, in a country of social media as where people get their information, I fear that a constitutional convention could take us in the wrong direction. What makes you, and Chile may be one of the answers, but what makes you more in favor of that?
Well, when you talk about a constitutional convention, there are two key questions that have to be settled in order to make sure it doesn't become a runaway convention. One is that you have to, you can decide what the mandate of that convention is. You don't have to have a convention in which, you know, all issues are on the table and all parts of the Constitution, the current Constitution, are on the table. You could have a narrowly constrained mandate around simply the rules in which we do our elections, and so that we correct for the defects in the current Constitution that don't allow for majority rule. It basically would be a constitutional convention with a mandate that is looking at why we don't have majority rule and how to fix that.
And let me ask you, Stephen, because I haven't dug deeply into this one. Wouldn't those same forces that I fear organize themselves to oppose such a mandate, and how would you propose or hope that such a focused mandate could be what we come up with.
Well, you have to. So the other thing, so is the mandate, and the other is the delegates need to be broadly represented. We can talk about that in a little bit, which is what Chile really excelled at. So in addition to that, and according to the U.S. Constitution, you need a two-thirds vote of all the states in order to call this convention. So that's a very high threshold. And, you know, the current effort to get to the 34 states that you need, it's not as clear-cut as what some people are saying, because some of those states have said, we want to do one, but it's around a different, slightly different mandate than what the than what other states have decided that they want to do around. So because it's happening in this kind of haphazard fashion without a lead from Congress itself, it's not clear that they are as close as they say they need to be.
Let me just throw this one. If you can't get the minority rule Senate to even do away with the filibuster, how could you trust that body to do a constitutional convention that might lessen the favoritism now shown to incumbents, for example, or to big money?
Well, if it comes from the states, but there's leadership from Congress, doesn't mean Congress has to sign off on it. Mm-hmm. There's leadership, and national voices are also pushing this idea. I think we could get two-thirds in the state if it's narrowly focused around these issues around how do we ensure majority rule. You know, majority rule used to be a mantra that appealed to people.
Yes.
On the right, and they always would say we have to have majority rule. And so, you know, if the right leadership is there, and then the other part of this is that whatever the Constitutional Convention comes up with, three-fourths of the states have to ratify.
Right.
So at that point, you know, really, if there was a runaway convention like people are fearing, that was coming up with, for example, locking into the Constitution the anti-abortionist position, and it was locking into the Constitution or getting rid of the Bill of Rights, it wouldn't get three-fourths of the states. So I think those thresholds are high enough. In fact, they're probably too high to really try to push forward something like this. But the other part of it, as I mentioned, is you have
Yes.
to have a diverse and representative body. And that's where, we would not want to have elections like we have in the United States for United States Congress, but in single-member districts, we would want to use some sort of proportional representation system for selecting the delegates to make sure it's diverse, having something like a mandate that they must be 50% women. In Chile, they also had a mandate for indigenous representation and for people with disabilities. So you could really look at the United States and see, okay, who do we need to make sure is at the table of this constitutional convention to debate ideas? The other thing they did in Chile was that you, any person who, even someone who's not a delegate, could go out and get a few thousand signatures on a petition for the idea that you want the Constitutional Convention to consider. And you could put that idea in front of those delegates, and they have to debate it and discuss it and vote up or down on it. In the Chile Constitutional Convention, it needs a two-thirds vote to actually go into the constitutional package. So it's a high threshold, but nevertheless, it creates a bit of what we sometimes call citizens' assembly type of input into this process. And so we would want to have a constitutional convention that not only has diverse representation on it, but incorporates the grassroots and people's voices from all over in every walk of life. We would want to have, you know, very everyday people as delegates, as well as participating in this, using the internet, using the web to live stream all of the convenings of the Constitutional Convention.
And let me just add a couple of specifics from what Chile achieved, which is two-thirds of the 155 convention delegates had no political party affiliation. That would appeal to Americans. And the thing that you mentioned about individuals being able to submit proposals, a million Chileans supported over 2,000 initiatives introduced by citizens, and 100 of those proposals reached the qualifying signature threshold to be submitted to the delegates. And then, as you said, it would take a two-thirds vote by the delegates for any proposal to ultimately be included in the final constitutional package. That kind of participation is impressive. I don't know that we'll have time to get into it, but just as looking at the opposite side, the low levels of participation in American elections, which are such a simpler process than this constitutional convention in Chile.
Well, I think people don't participate here because they realize they don't have any choice.
Yep.
There's nothing out there to vote for. I mean, the average voter is what I call an orphan voter. Mm-hmm. If you're a Democrat living in a Republican district, a Republican living in a Democratic district, or a third-party supporter or independent supporter. And so you basically live in the wrong district and sometimes even the wrong state. Entire states have become political monocultures. Here in California, where I live, the Republicans don't have a single elected office holder at the executive state level. And many states are this way for Democrats or Republicans. And so, you know, when you look out there on the political landscape, we like to say we have a two-party system.
Mm-mm.
But in fact, the frame of reference for most voters is living in a one-party system. And your only choice, if you want to call it that, is to ratify the candidate of the party that dominates your district or your state. So this is what most Americans are facing. And on Chile, I just want to mention one last thing.
Sure.
Because of the way they put some thought into making sure they had a diverse representative body, some of those delegates are people like a car mechanic, homemakers. There's several people who are homemakers, veterinarians, dentists, social workers, shop owners, one is a professional chess player, school teachers. These are the people who got picked into that constituent assembly to weigh in on what should be the new constitution of Chile, because they're trying to replace a constitution that was devised by the old dictatorship of General Pinochet.
So,
some of those constitutional members are 20, some of them are as young as 21 years old and as old as 81. So it's a very diverse body, and that's what we should be aspiring to here in the United States.
Right. Now, while in some small rural areas, you may be able to run for city council or state legislature without a ton of money, that's harder and harder. And so basically this notion of the kind of people who became delegates to this convention, in America, those people have very little chance of being elected even to local and state office. And so you have the opportunity then to hear from people who would never put aside their lives and their livelihoods and raise the kind of money it takes to be elected here. Let's jump, just because we sort of said, why can't we learn from other people? We've talked about Chile. Can you talk about what recently happened in Australia, which in a way was less radical than a constitutional convention, but really eye-opening in terms of what that election wrought?
Well, in Australia, they use different electoral methods than we use here in the United States. So for their House of Representatives, they do have single-seat districts, but they have what we call ranked choice voting, where voters get to rank first, second, third, fourth, fifth choices. And the goal of that method is to make sure that voters can really vote for the candidate they want and not be stuck in picking the lesser of two evils, because you can put your favorite candidate as your first ranking. And you know that if your first choice doesn't win, you don't lose your vote. Your vote is going to go to your second choice as your backup choice, like your runoff choice. So if you compare that to the 2000 presidential election, where Al Gore lost to George W. Bush by 537 votes in Florida, and Ralph Nader had 100,000 votes. Well, if those 100,000 votes for Ralph Nader, if they'd had the chance to rank a second choice as their backup choice in case Nader couldn't win, tens of thousands of them would have put Al Gore, and he would have won Florida and would have won the presidential election. And so in Australia, they've been doing this for 100 years. It's just really a great system. And increasingly, in the United States now, we're doing that in a number of cities. The state of Alaska is about to use ranked choice voting, with voters will rank their candidates for the first time in a congressional race and for a governor and other state offices. So that's one part of what Australia does. The other part is in their Senate, they actually use a proportional representation system, a ranked ballot proportional representation system, and that's where you see like a Green Party winning representation and other smaller parties win representation. And so there you can see two different systems side by side, one ranked choice voting in single member districts, the other ranked choice voting in multi-seat districts for proportional representation. And you see that they both give better representation than what we have here in the United States. In the recent election there, they had a lot of women were not satisfied with the amount of representation that women were getting, and they also were sort of wanted to have more of a centrist presence in their political spectrum. So a bunch of them got together and were able to run and to win representation and really rock the political establishment with all these new faces and new ideas that, really I think is something that, again, the United States should be learning from.
Yeah, and let me just ask you on the two or three changes that we've just talked about: one, a constitutional convention; two, proportional representation and ranked choice voting. What are you're dealing in the trenches on these things all the time? What do you think are the chances of, just talk about those three, and where does the energy have to come from? It seems to me that on the proportional representation and the ranked choice voting, we see it happening in cities. I believe San Francisco and New York both have it. Now, those are not, those are not insignificant places. And then there are states that have it. Is that one that has to move from the bottom up? And so I'm saying, what's your hope and what's the strategy on those?
Well, there's a lot of activity going on at local and state level right now. In fact, this November, the state of Nevada will be voting on using ranked choice voting for all of their elections. And the other cities will also be voting on it. The city of Portland, Oregon will be voting on a proportional representation system. Seattle will be voting on ranked choice voting. It is a whole bunch of activity going on all across the country, which is great to see. If you look at a place like New York City, for example, in their first ranked choice voting election, they went from a city council of 51 seats where the most women had ever won on that council were 14 out of 51 seats. In the first election, women won 31 out of 51 seats, so over 60%. 25 of them women of color. So New York City is almost a woman of color majority city council right now. With ranked choice voting, they have public financing of campaigns, and the organizations and candidates that were backed by these organizations use these ranked ballots very effectively to prevent split votes and spoiler candidates from knocking out, a woman of color. Before, you'd have several women of color running, and they would all knock each other out in a plurality system. With ranked choice voting and voters ranking their ballots, I can say, hey, put me first. And in case I don't win, put Terrence as your second choice. And you can have all these coalitions forming in a very flexible, live format that gives voters a lot more choice and gives the candidates a lot more flexibility about how they position themselves as candidates. So
it sounds like that particular reform is on the upswing and has and seems to have a chance of spreading well, whether yes. Whether it will ultimately persuade, be put in place for the House and the Senate is maybe another question, but
a bill has been introduced by Congressman Jamie Raskin and mm-hmm. other members of Congress called a Fair Representation Act, which would be to create a proportional representation system for the United States House of Representatives. So that's moving forward too, but that's gonna that's not gonna happen overnight.
Right. So, but it does sound like the grassroots. This is actually alive and well. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Stephen Hill. He's the author of a number of books, including 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. I mentioned that one because it is so germane to the conversation we're having. He's a co-founder of fairvote.org. And we're talking about what I consider to be one of the gravest and most systemic problems we face in America, from which you can then see both the reason we have the problems and the challenges we have to overcome them, which is minority rule, as most exemplified recently by the radical decisions of the minority selected Supreme Court. And you can learn more about Stephen's work at fairvote.org. That's fairvote, one word, at Stephen with a V, S-T-E-V-E-N hyphen Hill, stephenhill.com. And then he is writing frequently these days at Democracy SOS, all one word, Democracy SOS on Substack. So that's democracysos.substack.com. One other thing that's right next to proportional representation and ranked choice voting and so on is the problems created. And it seems to me here the solution is pretty obvious, but talk about it, of winner take all. And I'm going to ask you, how did that come about? And so if people don't think about it, what are the negative consequences? And then what are the alternatives and how are we moving forward?
Well, the winner take all system is a name that's been sort of evolved over time for what's called single member districts, plurality elections. Highest vote getter wins within the district. And people think, well, that, you know, seems like a simple system. We've been using it a long time. What could be wrong with that? Well, here's the thing that people really have to think about. You know, if you, when you elect a candidates in a winner take all system, it means you have a huge number of voters that are voting for losing candidates all the time. Because, you know, you can have a district where, you know, a Latino single mom Democrat lives next door to a pro-business libertarian, lives next door to a Green Party environmentalist, lives next door to a Republican moderate. And the reality is that only one of those people are going to get representation in our system. And everyone else loses. And that's why it's called winner take all. And so when you have a system like this, election after election, after a while you start figuring out, I don't have representation, there's no point in even voting. And that's why you see in winner-take-all methods, not just the United States, but in other countries that use it, voter turnout tends to be extremely low. When you start, and also that it has a lot of other implications for our system. So, you know, if I'm the head of the Democratic Party and you're the head of the Republican Party, we already know ahead of time who's going to win most of these races. So we're about to elect 435 House seats in November, and we can tell you right now who's going to win 90% of them. We can not only tell you who's going to win, we can tell you approximately the margin of victory. And so I can sit back and you can sit back and look at the political map and say, okay, this district over here, we know we've got that one won. We don't have to do anything there. This district over here, we know we're never going to win there. We're going to focus all of our resources on the handful of battleground districts. There's about 36 of them. There may be 38 to 40 out of 435 House seats that everybody knows are going to decide who controls the House of Representatives majority. And so it just distorts in our system in so many ways that people are not aware of. So when people think our system is simple, it's not simple at all. It's very primitive and antiquated because it means that for you, the voter, you don't have any choice. And for when you're trying to create policy, you know, if I win, if you lose, Terrence, if you're the other side, then I win. So I can win as easily by driving voters away from you as by attracting them to me. So the incentive is to go negative, use mudslinging in campaigns, and this type of winner-take-all system. If you go to something like proportional representation, it changes all of these incentives and all of these features, and you get voters who can win representation no matter where they live. What an idea that you could actually vote for someone and vote for a party and have them actually win representation. So there's a lot of things we could discuss around this, but that's in a nutshell is what we're dealing with this winner-take-all system.
And and just briefly, winner-take-all was not in the Constitution, right?
Right, it was not. They simply, in fact, when we first became a country, there were a number of states that elected their House of Representatives through an at-large system. So you had, what you saw was an interesting pattern where the big states, so Virginia, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, that had large populations, they would use districts, but the smaller states of Delaware and Rhode Island and others, they used an at-large system because they wanted to make sure that all the representatives from their state were from one political party to really maximize their influence in the House of Representatives. So in their own way, the framers knew what they were doing, but other methods like proportional representation had not even been invented yet.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in some ways, they were at the cutting edge of what I call democracy technology. They were experimenting with at-large versus districts. But proportional representation wasn't really invented until the 1870s. And since then, every established democracy that has come online as a democracy has not really adopted our proportional representation system. The only country still using it...
You mean our winner-take-all system?
Yeah, our winner-take-all system. The only country still using it are basically the United Kingdom and its colonies, Canada,
right.
U.S.
Right, so there's, you know, there's a thing when you go back and you say, but we were the first representative democracy, or, you know, without a king. The first means that the first person in a technology space is going to have the ultimate solution. Not always the case, not usually the case, but in with this one, we sort of hold that up as
I sometimes call it the operating system of democracy. So the operating system is like using the first version of DOS.
Right.
People don't even remember it anymore.
Right. Whereas, and as you say, certain improvements hadn't even been invented because there wasn't representative democracy. There was no, you know, no one was doing it. So how would they have the best software?
Exactly. So now we the other countries are using the version of the latest iOS for Apple and, the latest version of Windows. We're still stuck back on DOS.
So you're part of this is, and you may have said it briefly, but I want to focus on it again, is all of our districts are not just winner take all. They are single candidate districts. And you advocate for multiple seat districts. Explain that one a little bit.
Sure. So what we could do is the easiest thing would be just taking existing districts, and instead of having members of Congress elected one at a time in one in each district, you join them together into what we can call super districts, three-seat districts, five-seat districts. And with proportional representation, let's say in a five-seat district, it would take about 16% of the vote to win one of those five districts. One of those five seats in that five-seat district. And so that when you only need 16% of the vote, suddenly you can see, well, if, let's take an area like in the South, where right now mm-hmm. the South has completely polarized. You have black liberal Democrats getting elected from the cities in the South, and you have conservative, white conservative, usually male Republicans getting elected from everywhere else. If you had five-seat districts, then you would see that a Republican getting elected from Atlanta, for example,
mm-hmm.
you would get a black Democrat elected from one of the rural areas. And so you'd get a cross-pollinization of ideas within the caucuses, the Democratic and Republican caucuses, because, you know, you'd get Chicago Republicans getting elected.
Right. I understand. This split that has happened and perpetuates itself, which I think was present in the founding era, but is I think more dangerous now, is the rural-urban divide. And so as you're saying, right now, hard for a Republican to get elected in most urban areas, hard for a Democrat to get elected in most rural areas, and so you don't have rural Democrats and you don't have urban Republicans, and of course that experience and that perspective is missing.
Yes, and not only that, in many parts of the country it's not only a geographic split with a partisan flavor to it, it also has a racial flavor. And whenever these three factors of race, partisanship, and geography have come together in U.S. history, it's usually been explosive. And so that's really what we're facing. And I think that's why we're going to see more traction on these issues in the years going forward, because we've reached the end point of what this 18th century based political system can do and the good that it can do. At this point, it's like a coyote chewing on its own leg to get out of the trap.
Mm-hmm. So in some sense, that demographic shift that has been pointed to probably since about the turn of the century, that would inevitably lead to democratic rule, or, you know, I mean, capital D democratic, but has actually energized a very successful Republican reaction, which is much of what we talk about in terms of voter suppression, gerrymandering, et cetera, that in fact, what that demographic shift may be more important about is not which party ends up dominating, but whether reform ends up taking place.
Yes, and whether we can bring back into the U.S. political system the bridge builders in the legislatures. You know, the moderates are really who's been hollowed out and disappearing. They're extinct species at this point. And so those moderates in the legislatures are the bridge builders. They help find compromise. I mean, you know, politics is the art of compromise. You have to, everyone comes in with their own viewpoint. You have to sit around the table and figure out, how are we going to work together, and how are we going to come up with something that we all can live with at least a little bit? And that's what's missing in the U.S. political system right now. And it's purely a function. It's not about what Americans believe. In fact, you know, there's a study, an annual study called National Election Study, done out of University of Michigan. And they can show that the American people are no more divided today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. It's really a matter that the political system has completely obstructed the ability of public opinion to really have a say in what the policy coming out of our legislatures reflects that public
opinion. Let me quote the study, which you know very well, I'm sure, which is Martin Gillens of Princeton and Benjamin Page of Northwestern, in which they say that a proposed policy change with low support among economically elite Americans, let's say one out of five in favor, is adopted only about 18% of the time, while a proposed change with high support of the wealthy is adopted 45% of the time. When a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites or organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of the strong status quo bias built into the political system, even when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy changes, they generally do not get it. And as we said, this has feedback loops which lead to resignation, cynicism, tribalism, etc. I have often thought that the Beltway is where that partisan rancor is. The Beltway is where, within the Beltway in Washington, D.C., is not representative of America, obviously, as we've pointed out, the structure doesn't allow for it to be, and that's where the stalemate and the gridlock is, not in the American people themselves.
And also, you know, another factor in this is the primary system that we have.
Of course,
because if it's true as I'm saying that, you know, these single member districts, we can already tell you who are going to win 90% of them right now. That means that election is actually being decided in the partisan primary of the party that dominates that district, and those tend to be low turnout affairs in which the extremes are motivated to turn out more than the moderates. And so that's why you see more extreme candidates being elected, particularly, I think, on the Republican side.
Absolutely.
They win those partisan primaries, and now they're going forward against a Democrat in a heavily Republican district. So, of course, they get elected in that district. So, you know, if we in Nevada, as I mentioned, they have reform on the ballot this November. It's going to be for what's called a top four primary. So, you'll have a primary still, but instead of just it's an open primary where every voter can vote for all candidates from all political parties. It's not a closed partisan primary anymore there. And the top four will go to the November election, and they'll use ranked choice voting to decide the winner there so that you don't end up with spoilers and split votes. So this is another model that is gaining traction, and that's what Alaska passed a couple of years ago, and they're now going to use a top four primary with ranked choice voting, open primary, for their elections this November.
Wow, smells suspiciously like actual democracy. Let me ask you, I just want to say that there are other reforms we're not going to have a chance to deal with. One is the National Popular Vote Compact, which we certainly would love to see. Another is universal automatic voter registration. There's a number of things. If you are despairing, there are a number of things which could turn things around. But let me ask you kind of a way out there question, which is, have we been such poor stewards of democracy, with money dominating politics and an inability to solve problems or promote the general welfare? That is to say that, you know, the American people have moved, I think, to have a lot of majority correct opinions. They just can't get them passed. But have we been such poor stewards of democracy that China will end up leading the world's response to climate change and then possibly future pandemics as well, because authoritarianism has real advantages when confronting big problems that call for rapid pivots, mobilization. What FDR could do in World War II, China can do every day of the week. And my sense is that unless democracy becomes a more successful force in America for good in confronting climate change and other of those crises that I mentioned at the top, China will end up with authoritarianism leading the world forward. And I think, I mean, that's got to be the good news, bad news kind of thing that is scary to me.
Well, the thing with authoritarianism is that it's great when it really leads in the right direction, but it's a disaster when it leads in the wrong direction.
Of course.
And it can lead in the right direction for a few years and then become a disaster. I mean, look at China's policy on COVID, in which they basically quarantined the entire country virtually in their homes. And, it hasn't actually worked out to even reduce COVID very well. So I don't put a lot of faith in authoritarianism or in China. I think Winston Churchill said it best. He said, democracy is the worst form of government, except all the others that have been tried. And if you look actually at, say, in the EU, in the European Union, they've done more to rein in their carbon emissions than China has done, and certainly more than we have done. And they also just passed laws trying to rein in, you know, the Facebook and the
yes,
the
they do.
This is going on online platforms and Amazon, where they manipulate consumers and small businesses. And so I think if you look at a place, that's why I wrote that book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope in an Insecure Age. You can see that democracy does work. It's messy, of course. The Germany, France, Sweden, these countries, they have their problems for sure. But they have a real democracy that allows this dialogue between the center and the margins, as I mentioned earlier, that allows them to brainstorm ideas and come up with real solutions. And yes, it's messy in the short term while they're coming up with those ideas, but once they figure it out, they plunge forward. And so when it comes to, you know, the environment and carbon emissions, you do see much better mass transit systems, far better than what we have.
Of course.
You know, I would compare it to like a LeBron James jump shot, and we're still playing high school basketball here. You still see things like housing and, pensions and whether people have enough things, health care, for example. They have better systems that they've devised over years. It does take time, but if you have a functioning democracy, it really does work. And in fact, I would say one of the things I think we're going to see is more and more people in the United States become so concerned with climate change and other important issues that affect their lives and that the U.S. must solve, that there is one issue to all these issues that is fundamental to all of them, which is having a functioning democracy.
Excellent. So the counterpoint is not that that China has an advantage with authoritarianism. It's that real democracy is what's needed here, which is what we've been talking about for the hour. So again, you can learn more at fairvote.org. That's fairvote, one word. You can also go to stephen-hill.com. That's Stephen, S-T-E-V-E-N, -hill.com. And sign up and read his frequent newsletters at democracysos.substack.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, about, and usually 10 articles to flesh out the conversation. Sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y, at mac.com. And you can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast at Apple Podcast and most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there and at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, Stephen Hill, thank you for sticking at this work and for 30 years, and keep up this good work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Terrence. It's been my pleasure to join you again.
Great.